it's kind of the close of Open Ed Week, and I just thought, you know, I thought it would be just fantastic to close the week hanging out with Grant Potter. And I think of Grant Potter as almost like the exemplar Open Ed hacker, tinkerer, bootstrapper, stomper of Terra. One of the things I just love about Grant is every time I talk to him, there's always some kind of like duct tape and baling wire, incredibly inventive, fun invention that he's working on, either with faculty at the University of Northern British Columbia or fun people like that, or just out in the world. And I think the fact that we got some people here kind of outside the British Columbia scene that have joined the chat speaks to that, because Grant's done so many things that have really extended truly around the world. And we'll talk about a few of those here. Grant, before I start firing any questions, did you want to send a little greeting out to our little group here?
Thank you, everybody, for attending our little session here. This is the first Open Ed BC chat where everything I say will be accompanied by a banjo.
Fantastic. Oh, my God. I can't believe I left my theremin at home. all right, so that definitely puts a different cast on what we're going to be talking about around the Cracker Barrel today. I'm at a loss. Okay, well, I'm going to start, Grant, because I've known you for a long time. Actually, I think you were once actually. I think when I first met you, you were working in China at the time, and then before that, I think you were working in the North. And I'm wondering if you might accompanied or not with the banjo. Talk about some of the things you were doing in kind of those earlier kind of initiatives with EdTech, because I think a lot of that speaks to the kind of work and stuff that you've done in the past, or that you'd be doing now, I should say.
Yeah, I won't use the banjo for this part because it's kind of hard to play and tell a story at the same time. I don't really have my Pete Seeger skills up to snuff. So, I started getting involved with, well, for anybody that knows me, knows that I came to educational technology through my work as a teacher in the K-12 system. So I used to, I taught at a community school going back a long time ago in the Northwest Territories. I taught, I was basically one half of a high school portion of a community school, and after a little while became the principal there. And I happened to be living there at a time when the internet came to the Arctic. So I got a fair bit of training actually through the education, culture, and employment in the Northwest Territories on networking, Cisco networking. So I already came to my career as an educator with a technical background. I used to be a database administrator. So it was sort of kind of a perfect storm for me. I happened to be in a school that really needed technical assistance and needed somebody to, you know, keep the lights on and move some of these things forward. So I worked with education, culture, and employment in the Northwest Territories on lots of curriculum design, instructional design, stuff involving technology. And after I did that, I moved to China, and I took a job there working at a BC offshore school, a private school. And I was teaching AP computer science, so basically Java for grade 11 and 12 students in China. And while there, I was involved in a bunch of projects, like the school that I was in, an old resort in the Northeast in a city called Dalian, and didn't have any infrastructure at all, no groupware for teachers, no collaboration platforms, there wasn't even email, really. So when I arrived with students, we started setting up wireless networks all over campus, and that was part of their exercise in some IT classes to actually set up that infrastructure. So I brought to bear some of my skills as a technician and some of my skills as an educator to work in some of these areas. So it wasn't really, I guess it was kind of ed tech, but it was ed tech in the, you know, that was couched in the outcomes of a classroom. So and then after that, I started working for UMBC, and instead of working in the K-12, started working post-secondary, doing a lot of the same stuff, but working with more with faculty and less with students.
Can I circle back to the job you did in the North? Because that was, I think, the first time you actually connected radio with your teaching and learning, right?
That's right. Yeah. Well, when I was there, and I told this story at a talk I did at UNBC back in January, where there was a radio station there that was that would broadcast Radio Bingo, and that's the only time that it got used. And it used to actually be the old CBC repeater. Clavick used to be the seat of government back going back to the early 50s. Before Yellowknife. So the CBC had all this broadcasting gear there, and it was only used when I was there to broadcast Radio Bingo. So I brought some students to the broadcasting technology, and we started looking at ways that we could use it for more than Radio Bingo. And we started out with doing some little documentaries, and then on to some recorded spoken word pieces. A lot of students had their own radio shows, and it was really interesting, though, because at that radio station served as like a, it was there functioning as a communication mechanism for the community before the internet arrived. Because where he lived in the Clavick on the Mackenzie Delta, it's very flat. So if you can take a 10 megawatt transmitter, that goes a long way. Like we were in some cases had the same broadcasting radios as some of the trappers' radios. So quite often something that we'd be doing is, you know, in our radio shows, we'd be sending messages out to trappers that are in their cabins. So it's like, Pete, you need to, call home on the radio, or you should be back tomorrow morning because we need, like, we'd send all those kind of messages out to the trappers' radio. So it was really fun. Really had a good, and we learned a lot about broadcasting at the time, too, and all the technologies involved.
I guess what I love about hearing stories like that too is, and where so much of the work, and still I think the work you still do, is you don't seem to let, you know, I think a lot of us, it's like, well, we don't have the tools in place, we don't have the infrastructure, we don't have the capacity. And it seems like every time I'm talking to you, you've always got something on the go where you're just taking something that's either being unused or something that's highly accessible and quite even like old tech, to do what you got to do. And I think we're going to definitely have to post some of the links to the presentation, either the one you did at UNBC, or I think you also used these clips at a talk you did at University of Mary Washington on tinkering, which is on Vimeo somewhere. I'll have to dig that URL up. It's a spectacular talk. With some of the clips of this, because you actually had the students doing radio broadcasts eventually.
Yeah, and I thought I'd lost a lot of those clips. I had a few clips at the time that I did the Mary Washington presentation, but I've since found a lot more recordings that I have of some of the students' work, but also some work that I was doing with the Gwich'in Tribal Council on a project for an online dictionary. So it would be, but it never did get off the ground, but we got some of the early stages of it done. So I'm in the process of getting all of that information back to the Gwich'in Tribal Council and offering them my help if they need work or would like to pursue now, more than 15 years later. But we have some really great recordings of elders that were in language teachers that were basically reading through vocabulary lists. We recorded them and made them into digital files and looking at some way of creating this online language lab. But so maybe that'll be something that surfaces again in 2014. It would be great to take something that I did in 2000 and breathe new life into it.
Cool. So you started to talk about how you'd moved on to UNBC, and there's a couple of things that you've done there that I intend to specifically ask about, but were there any things you wanted to share that, of work that you've done, you know, either when you started at UNBC or more recently that intrigue that you'd like to share before I start throwing stuff at you?
Well, I do have something that I've been working on for the last little while, for a few months, but actually, no, going back more like 2 years, but it's sort of had peaks and valleys, but it's using story-based simulations, so they're all commonly known as virtual patients, and a lot of people use them. There are a lot of universities in not only in BC, but in Canada that use these. They're really popular in Northern Ontario. There's all kinds of proprietary platforms that allow you to create them. So think of them as like interactive fiction, but interactive fiction that can branch and that can loop back, and there can be recursion on a number of the branches. So I was looking at a number of platforms that would allow our nursing program, as well as anyone else who might be interested, to develop, and in a very easy way, develop some of these branching stories and then put them online without having to know a great deal of HTML or web design. So I did find something, and it's called, let's put a link here in to the GitHub. The GitHub page is called Open Labyrinth, and I believe it's maintained by a group at the University of Calgary, but they have partners all over North America as well as in the EU. So basically what it does is it allows you to create concept maps of essentially like a patient or a scenario or a series of events, and these events can either be linear or semi-linear, or branch off and then have recursion back. And I've got a couple, when I'm using these words, I have a couple images here to sort of illustrate what I'm getting at by linear. So here's a URL to basically a story path that would be linear, going from one node to the next. And I guess that's sort of the way that fiction works, sort of. You read through, except for Choose Your Own Adventures, like you read, you start on page one and you read through to the last page. So with some of the software, what it allows you to do is a little bit of some semi-linear storytelling. So here's another another URL that sort of breaks down the idea of semi-linear. So you have these key events that will happen in a narrative. And I like that image because it shows a narrative as a number of key node beats. So I know that Jason's on the line. I've watched him use Tractor, and that's something that you do when you're mixing audio. You're looking for, you know, the one, two, and the three, and the four. You're looking for these downbeats, right? So, but within each, you know, segment between nodes, there are many different ways to get between node to node. You're still essentially in a linear path, but you're, you know, you have a little freedom in between these key narrative pieces and narrative points.
Okay,
so what we're doing with, sorry, go ahead.
Just to clarify, so just make sure I understand I'm following you. I know I always do this to you. So that Kubazar link with the beats and branching filler image is what I'm looking at right now. So so you got these keynote beats and then these so-called branching fillers. So the keynote beat is almost like are kind of like universal points, like collections of either text or a concept or an image or something that everything gets filtered into. And then these branching filler sections are kind of more kind of looping or self-directed by whoever is processing through it. But the idea is it does eventually get guided back to these kind of core elements that are like the keynote beat that gets put
in. Yeah, essentially, yeah. So that maybe they would be key pieces, and if you're talking from a teaching and learning perspective, these are key topics or pieces of content that you would want students to interact with. Now we're talking about virtual patients. You'd be talking about a clinical situation. So there would be certain types of information or experience that you'd want this nursing student or this medical student to be exposed to in between those points, whether that be a diagnostic or interviews with a potential patient. There would be certain key points that you'd want students to reach. So something that with Open Labyrinth allows, and now there's lots of different some pieces of software that allow you to do interactive fiction, so you could do a similar kind of thing. And I've got a couple of those I can share with you after, but something I liked about Open Labyrinth is it allows you to create rules and create counters in some of these branching pieces, so that let's say there are some avenues that are more advantageous than others. So maybe there are five or six ways to get in between these pieces, but there's a preferred way, and then there's a least satisfactory way. So there's ways of actually scoring, I mean, for lack of a better term, scoring a person's a progress to a narrative. And so providing some either direct feedback to the student at intervals or at the end.
Wow. So,
go ahead.
No, I was going to let you get back onto what you were going to say, but I was just going to circle back if you could remind me which discipline you were using this for.
This one is going to be used in nursing. I do have some other links I'll share in a bit where it's been used in pre-med programs. People may be familiar with mannequins. You know, I think the provincial government invested a significant amount of money in high fidelity simulations. So those are those silicon mannequins that are filled with microcontrollers that have pulses. They have there's ways of students can do injections and all sorts of things. So those, when I talk about high fidelity simulations, that's what I'm getting at, and that's why I call these low fidelity, because they're online, they're remixable, they're shareable. They can include image maps and like clickable image maps and video and such, but I classify them as low fidelity because they can also be developed fairly rapidly with tools like Open Labyrinth. And so what we have at Open Labyrinth is we have our platform hosted at virtualpatients.org, and that is made possible by Domain of One's Own. That's who it's hosted with. And that's the Mary Washington program. One other piece that I wanted to get at here is one example. I love this image too, of what I call, I think there must be another name for it, but I call it branching with recursion. So this is like a really interesting visual of analysis of the path and outcome of a choose your own adventure. Choose your own adventure number 2, Journey Under the Sea. So you can see there are lots of branching. There's the ability to loop back to certain points. So if you imagine something like this, so a branching narrative with recursion, and is at certain points you can have counters so that certain pathways can't be repeated more than once, or certain pathways perhaps penalize you and some award you points or whatever the way you want to mark it. You can see there's a way that we can actually create, I hesitate to use the word game, but you can create a pathway, so a narrative pathway that allows the user a little bit of feedback, and it gives them some at least a gauge of quality of their performance.
Right. I'm fascinated by this idea that certain pathways could be, like you were saying, even scored as kind of almost higher than the others. So even the person could be proceeding through, if I'm understanding you right, I always do this. If I'm understanding you kind of proceed through the narrative, but you could almost get a sense by the path they're taking how well they may have grasped the foundational material or preparation or whatever when they go into it. So it could almost be
right. And if you think of this in a clinical situation too, there are obviously certain diagnostics that will be more beneficial to the patient or the end user, and there are certain pathways that will involve their patient or the user in a whole range of diagnostics that may be unnecessary. So of course, unnecessary procedures in the clinical case will be considered to be less favorable than being able to diagnose quickly what's wrong with the patient.
Okay, cool.
So I got a couple more examples here. So just, there's some really cool, I've got a link to a video here that illustrates what this branching and recursion, I did a screen capture and put it in an animation. I'll just give you guys a minute to watch that. It's an MP4.
I might be getting an error on the...
Oh yeah, I might have got an error. That's okay. I'll send you directly to the animation on the page.
The weird thing is what's happening is what I figured out what's wrong with that. If you click the link, the Dropbox link, for some reason my browser stripped out the colon after HTTPS and just went straight to the two slashes. So if I click if I just add a colon into that URL, then it did work.
Oh, okay. So I'll just leave it in the chat there so people can take a look at it. But I got it from the site that I put in. I put in a URL, semizdat.cc, and there's a really good project where this guy's gone through and he's done an analysis on some of these old choose your own adventure games, and there's some really great visualizations of how some of the narrative has looped back to key pieces in a plot line. And so I just wanted to share that out. He's done it, you know, and he's provided in the top left-hand corner, you're going to see a link for animations, which kind of illustrate in a different way what I've been talking about with branching with recursion.
So those little dots that are flowing along in those patterns, that represents different people progressing through those paths and the order that they went through the different sections?
No, that just represents pathways through the narrative. So, for example, in the beginning, you'll see there's a cluster of white dots. So there's a lot of back and forth in the beginning. And as you proceed a little further, you can take bigger hops. And then you can take these big leaps to the end of the story. So, or you can take a bunch of small hops and loop back and keep looping back until you proceed. And what he's done is color-coded some of those different bars in the narrative represent positive and negative outcomes. I can't remember right offhand. I think it was red was a negative outcome and the lighter colors were positive outcomes.
So that's Samizdat link. Yeah, I looked at that just now as you were talking, and that kind of illustrates, yeah, a bit more about what the relationship of those different things is. That's cool.
That's just a different way of looking at it. And he's done a really good job. I'd like to get some more information on the author of this, because he's actually done this with a bunch of choose your own adventure. So they do a great job of illustrating that idea of branching.
Right.
So yeah, like I was saying, there's a group, and I'm glad Darcy's on the line because he may know who these folks are, because they're listed, and he'll put another link in there, as being one of this Open Labyrinth software. They're listed as being one of the institutions here that are working on it. And I've been playing on and off with this since 2011, but when it first emerged, I think when I first saw it in 2010, it was not very stable, and it wasn't even a LAMP application, and it went on .NET, and it took a lot of time for me to actually get it to a workable state. And they went back to the drawing board, the collaborators, and they revamped it as a LAMP application that's using, and they also have some clever uses of JavaScript for a visual editor. So you can build some of these as concept maps using an in-browser concept map creator, so using a combination of HTML5 and JavaScript. So this latest version they released last year, really good. So it's certainly made significant improvements in my ability to use the platform.
Cool.
And there's Tanis. And this is one, and I'm glad to see you're here, Tanis, because Tanis and I started working on this project going back a couple years as an OPDF project from BC campus. And when we first started using it, it was in .NET, and oh, it was a nightmare. It didn't work very well. But this latest this update is of middle of last year, or late last year, is significant improvement. So I'm really hoping that we'll be able to get some momentum with it.
Very cool. So I don't know if you have more to say on that, and also we can just kind of pause here too. We have a number of people here. If anyone wants to jump in, ask a question on their own, either on the text or on the mic, we can take a deep breath and somebody can jump in if they like.
While we're pausing, I'm just going to put a few more links in here just to, because I have a couple examples. For the purposes of the archive, I'll gather all these together and we can just list them with the archive too. Now, if no one has any questions, there are. It's possible to create these sort of branching narratives without Open Labyrinth. But the piece in Open Labyrinth that I was interested in is the ability to add rules, so you could close off certain branches of the narrative after it's been passed once or twice or whatever the rules you want to apply, and the idea of counters, the idea of certain pathways through a branch narrative that would be preferable. So you could allow perhaps students potentially to go 12, 15 different ways through, and you can rank them as a subject matter expert as to which one would be the most preferable, and then you cascade them out and down and score them accordingly. I don't really see this as a testing mechanism. I see it as more of a self-assessment, you know, tool. A lot, and I don't see it as not being used just for nursing. There was a really good one, an example here that doesn't use Open Labyrinth, but it uses another narrative interactive fiction tool called Choice Script. And this one was called Dilemma. And it presents a user with a series of moral dilemmas, and how you proceed through your day depends on how you respond to these moral dilemmas. And I think, so there's potential there to use this in philosophy, in psychology courses, so outside of, you know, necessarily clinical and medical training. So I'm hoping to, you know, look at ways that we could use this in, across disciplines.
Cool. Grant, I don't know how, like, obviously you're watching the text, so you see Clint's question there on using this as alternative to the high fidelity simulations, which actually Darcy shared a really interesting example of that earlier up on the text as well. Do you see this complement?
Yeah, I saw the one that Darcy had there, and I'm just looking at Clint's question. No, these aren't going to be an alternative to the high fidelity simulations. When I first started exploring these, it came out of conversations I was having with nursing faculty about these things called OSCE exams. So an OSCE exam, if you're not familiar with nursing education, are these exams where people are trained as actors. So they're actually people from the public, I guess, and sometimes in cases people with theater experience or acting experience, and they are trained to respond a certain way to student questions. So they are in a room with a real person going through a scenario, and the person acts through the scenario as they've been trained. So there are very high stakes, high stress situation for nursing students. So talking with some nursing faculty, we wondered if there were ways that we could create scenarios or similar situations could run through online to allow students to have a little bit of clinical experience or exposure to clinical situations and receive some feedback in their progress and through some of these situations and scenarios to lower some of their stress level before they get into these OSCE. So that was the seed of how I started looking into these platforms, and I'd say that started in maybe 2011, and I've just been working forward since then. And like as I was saying, there are here's another really interesting open source tool that you can use to create these narratives. There's no scoring or rules involved, but if you haven't heard of Twine, you really should check that out. There are really, really interesting stories that are created with that software, and allows for branch narrative. Back a few months ago, I put a Twine assignment in the DS106 assignment bank, so as a writing option for students. And I haven't done one myself yet, but I gotta sort of dust off the cobwebs off my story writing skills and try myself with Twine. And the other one I mentioned earlier too was the one that's put out. It's called Choice Script by Choice of Games. Similar thing, allows you to create branch narratives, export them as HTML files, and then host them wherever you like. I've seen a lot of these that are created by Twine and Choice of Games to list in people's Dropbox sites. So they put them in a shared folder, and they can run, you know, from simple file sharing sites. I've got a couple examples. I've got a really good example of a Twine I like, and it's called Don't Read the Comments. I think it would be kind of fun if you were, you know, to take students through a Twine like this with regards to orient them to publishing online. If you read through the story, it's very clever.
Well, this looks really cool. Anyone that would be interested in kind of almost like the social dynamics of running a website, right, kind of take people out into the world and the kind of stuff they might get hit with.
Exactly.
Wow, this looks super cool. I am. Some of the people on this line might be aware of the Digital Tattoo Project, which was spearheaded by a number of people at UBC, Cindy Underhill in particular. This looks like something that would be really cool in that framework. And, you know, there's a number of people on this talk as well. We've had discussions on how to kind of support so-called open practices and open online platform and just getting people out onto the World Wide Web as opposed to in the gated a walled garden type approach. And this looks like a really interesting resource. Thank you for that.
So I've got tons of other links and things, but I've been throwing links at you like crazy. Well, maybe one more thing that I meant to mention that I didn't before. One thing I really liked about Open Labyrinth as a platform is it allows you to create these stories in a very visual way, or create the narratives in a visual way. So in the chat, I've just put another link, a piece of software called it's from Tufts University called the Visual Understanding Environment. Essentially, it's just a concept mapping tool. It's an open source concept mapping tool. So imagine if you could, you essentially draw out your narrative. You have lines that can either be can go in one way, or they can be bidirectional. You can have a fairly complex branch narrative with all sorts of arrows pointing all sorts of blocks. And within those blocks, you can put text and links to images. You can put straight HTML and CSS markup, and you can import those directly into Open Labyrinth, which is really great. So in a way, you can build some of these narratives completely offline, use in a very graphical way, and then import them to the platform. I wouldn't say it's a 100% perfect import, but a lot of the heavy lifting can be done offline and imported as an XML file, and then tweaked, and some of the default skins for Open Labyrinth leave a lot to be desired, but anyone with some time to do some CSS and some design work could really make them look great.
I have a little anecdote about that view site, which actually impacts another person on this chat. I had this fellowship where I got this really sweet trip, and it was about this project, and I didn't really ask about what the project was about, and then it was like the first day of work we started doing it, and it turned out it was going to be this like attempt to take a DSpace repository, but they wanted to be able to make it visual and interactive. And it was just like, I'm sitting there and I realized I don't know anything about any of this stuff, and they've got the wrong person for this fellowship, but it's going to be a total disaster. And I ended up writing a blog post about it, just basically acknowledging the problem and saying, does anybody out there know what to do? And Tanis, who's on this call, sent me a link to that view. And we ended up using that to put together a very quick prototype of like a visual interface that would actually navigate through different files on this DSpace interface. And it ended up being very useful. So, thanks, Tanis. I don't know if I think I thanked you in a public blog post a couple of years ago, but that was a very, I use that anecdote a lot of times. It's just kind of like the benefits of doing things like, you know, blogging and sharing process and putting your stuff out there and acknowledging you're in over your head, because it's amazing what this community can do. So sorry to take you off the rails, but yeah, I'll just endorse that site and thanks again, Tanis.
Just see Darcy's comment, but that's cheating. I've kind of talked at you guys a lot there, telling you about what I'm doing. Did anyone have any questions or things that they also wanted to chat about? I've got a couple other things, but I'm kind of monopolizing everyone's time here.
I realized too, we kind of blew past that twine, and that looks interesting as well. I've never seen that before. I'm just looking at that right now.
There's a really good, I'll just throw another link in here, bomb you with yet another link, but this is a really good, it's a wiki actually, and it goes through step by step how Twine works, and it does a really good, clean job of, you know, documenting how you would put a simple branch narrative together using Twine.
So do anyone, other questions on this notion of concept maps and simulations? Thank you for everyone who's been posting links in there. This is actually an area that I really have always been very ignorant on, but it's got me really thinking, which is always rare. Very cool. Well, I don't hear anyone else jumping in. If anyone wants to take the mic, feel free to just jump on or flag it in the text. But there was one other kind of new thing we were chatting about yesterday, Grant, that it sounds like pretty cool and exciting thing happening at UNBC and perhaps in BC in general around an English course. Did you want to chat a bit about that?
Yes, I am happy to announce that on the calendar at UNBC for spring of 2014, we're offering a I don't think that's going to hyperlink properly in the chat window there, but you can copy and paste it in. We're offering English 304, which is called, it's in the calendar as digital art, and we're offering it as DS 106. So we'll be allowing students to, or hopefully to get at least a dozen students, so we can run the course for credit. I'll be playing with DS 106 regardless in the spring, summer, and I always love hanging out with those crazy creative people. So, but I've been trying for the last little while to build some opportunity at UNBC where if students were interested in going through the DS 106 experience and receiving a credit, they would be might be able to do so through UNBC. So it looks like we have that in place. So let's cross our fingers and hope that people will be able to have that opportunity.
This is so cool, and it's great. Oh, Alan is still on the line here. I just wanted to give a shout out to him. One thing that's kind of been cool about DS 106 is not only the kind of the children of DS 106, like the one you've got here, but just a quick shout out to Alan. Maybe he'll fire a link to something recent. Breaking out some of the capacity around DS 106, like the assignment bank, which is I think one of the most kind of creative and kind of extensible ideas to come out of DS 106 that can apply in any discipline. And Alan's, I thought, done some pretty amazing work to extend out that kind of capacity. So it's great to see this kind of, child of DS 106. Grant, I don't know how far you've gotten in terms of thinking about how you're going to deliver this. I mean, some people have done DS 106 where essentially they just kind of link it into the kind of the existing, if there's an iteration of it being delivered at UMW or a headless iteration and just kind of following along. And then there's other people. I know when Scott Lowe did his iteration of it, he made quite a few changes in terms of how it was structured and the type of instruction and support that was happening given how his student body was working. So have you given any thought to how it's going to work at UNBC?
Well, right now it's looking like it'll be very close in lining up to with an offering that's going, and Alan may be able to correct me on this one, but there should be one being offered this summer. So this one is slated for July and August, and I believe there's one being offered at UMW in July and August. What I'm hoping is to be able to align the timelines with the students at UMW or wherever other courses are happening, so it allows some of that critical mass, some of that flow between students and real-time concurrent flow. So that's what I'm hoping for, but as the time approaches, we'll get a better sense of it. But I'm going to be running it in a very similar way it's been run before by Alan and Jim, is that I will have students have their own space and feed into the regular DS106.us flow.
And not to get too geeky, but it's stuff that's very much on my mind. When you have the students set up their own space, are you going to do that on a UNBC server? Are you going to send them to Reclaim or some other space? Or are you going to let them choose their own?
I'm going to let them choose their own, but I'm going to open up a couple different opportunities at the domain of one's own. I'll put that out as an option for them, and I'll outline a number of options. They can choose the one they think fits their purposes best.
And of course, you have an interesting working relationship because you spend most of the time in Nova Scotia with your banjo, and occasionally, you come back for on-campus stuff at UNBC. Have you kind of thought through how that's going to work?
Yeah, this is going to be this will be all only offered online, so it's all offered as a fully online course and through UNBC. So it kind of works out perfect with my schedule.
Nice. Well, that's going to be fantastic to see. Since we're on the subject here.
So right now I think we have, we're looking for, oh, sorry. I was just going to say we're looking for 10 to 12 students. And at present, I think we have four students. So we got a little time yet. We'll see how it goes. But hopeful that just in this initial piece, we've got quite a fair bit of interest from students, and lots of emails from students asking questions, what is this about, and so we'll see how it goes.
This would be an undergraduate course. I'm trying to think about how articulation agreements or whatever might work so that potentially other BC institutions might even be able to direct students to this. I wonder if that's possible, doable credit transfer.
Right. And one thing, and you'll see in the calendar entry, it lists that there's a prerequisite required, and I get permission from the chair to waive it at my discretion. So I think that that some of those prerequisite pieces won't be an impediment to any student that I can work them through the processes.
Very cool. Well, that'll be fantastic. And of course, for people who, I think most of the people on this call know that you've kind of done heroic work for kind of the infrastructure of DS106 in a number of ways, not least with DS106 radio, which still just blows my mind that I have access to an online radio station anytime. And actually, we're not broadcasting on it now. I don't know why. It's almost something like I take such comfort in having it there. Sometimes I forget that I could be living my life on radio if I wanted to. And just what a fantastic thing is. I see Jason here is on the call. Jason, it's just such a fantastic thing to be on the radio. Last Friday night, we live out at Paul Lake, and we're like an hour outside of Kamloops, and we moved here a year ago. So it's a quiet night out in the middle of nowhere for us. But there's DJ Dr. Jones spinning a dance party on Friday night, and we're seeing friends from mostly in North America, but frequently all around the world. Actually, as towards the end of the gathering, usually people from Australia and New Zealand join in. And Dr. Jones spinning these fantastic live tracks. Before that, we had another fellow who I won't name because he had this very honest and kind of vulnerable discussion about some stuff he had been reading. And how that was affecting how he was feeling about his work as a learning management system administrator. But it was intermixed with fantastic music and things like that. So, the DS106 radio space to me is just such a really special space. And, as we're kind of bringing the formal, just want to give you another shout out for that, Grant. And I know you kind of vowed that you were done talking about it in presentations and things like that. So that's why I'm doing this to you now.
Oh well, I'm glad you brought it up because I want to do because Alan's here and I want to give him huge props for managing the stage. I backed away a little bit. I kept the power on and made sure that the actors were paid. But as far as like syndicating of all the other live stations in through the scheduling, all of that's like for the last long while, months and months, it's been Alan. So he's really been. He's been a DS106 radio hero.
Yeah, actually, that's very true. And thank you for making that point. And I'm just trying to dig up the dashboard that he did, because that's just a fantastic way for people to be able to get into the station. I think for a lot of times when DS106 was first getting up and running, it was a bit intimidating, I think, to newcomers because you kind of had to at least know how to download an application, put in the protocols. The listening, sometimes it worked when you just tried to listen through the online interface. Sometimes it did, sometimes it didn't. But that's really gotten tightened up now, and I think Alan did most of that work. So thank you again for that, Alan.
And I'm going to make a request. I want to know what Radio Free Calgary is.
I think we have Darcy on the line. Does Darcy want to talk about Radio Free Calgary?
So what is radio? Can you hear?
Yeah, I can hear
you. Okay, awesome. I didn't know if it actually worked. Oh, it works. I just plugged in a new microphone and that was surprised. So Radio Free U Calgary is basically cloning the awesome stuff that you did, Grant, and trying to provide it on a context for campus here. We've got a lot of really cool digital humanities projects. And one is actually, I helped co-author a Shirk proposal to look at, he was calling it podcasting, but it's not podcasting. It's basically how do you do performance of literature? And he's thinking about recording MP3s and stuff. I was like, bullshit, you need a radio station. And so what if we have that as a platform for their students to do stuff? And what if we open up and we have a campus radio station, but not everybody has their show? What happens if we do that? So I'm just trying to see what happens if we spin up something like DS106 Radio, but hand the keys to people on campus here without taking over DS106 Radio itself.
That's fantastic. I'm really looking forward to... seeing that emerge, that's brilliant.
I don't know if I'm going to be able to pull it, because like I mentioned in the chat there, I'm kind of freaked out by the copyright implications of this. I think if we're not recording it, if there's no archive of it, I think we'll be able to get around it because it's basically it's a performance, and we're allowed to perform copyrighted works in the classroom. So if we treat it like a synchronous extension of a classroom as opposed to an on-demand radio station, I think we'll get around some of that. But yeah, so we've got this new server in our IT data center where blogs and wikis have moved to, and one of the things I want to do is look at getting the software in place to do that too, and some other stuff. I mean, what the so basically what I'm doing is copying GIS 106 and copying BC Campus. So copy and paste. I'm inspired by it. That's what I mean.
Well, like, please keep us up to date on your blog as it moves forward, because one thing that the DS106 radio uses airtime, software, the automation software, radio station automation software. One thing it does is you can pull a live audio feed and you can syndicate it into your own schedule. So you can count on Radio Free U Calgary being syndicated at DS106 radio.
Right on. Oh, that's cool. And what I'm thinking you're doing is during downtime, I'll just put our campus radio station through it.
Yeah.
We have some really, really cool, like it's been going on for 20, I don't know, more than 20 years, our campus radio station, forever. And not a lot of people listen. We actually just had a student election. One of the referendums was, do we pay an extra dollar each student to keep the radio station going? They voted no. So what can we do to help support that?
Well, folks, it's about 7 minutes to the top of the hour. I really hope that somebody's got a couple questions and somebody else is going to take them up.
That's awesome.
I do have one more thing before the top of the hour that I could share.
Go for it.
Let's see where we got. March 29th. This month is the 10th year anniversary of the Arduino. And there's a map there. All kinds of Arduino events going on all over North America. And not sure if people are familiar with what the Arduino is, but for people that like to tinker around and play with and hack some hardware, it's essentially a microcontroller that comes with a programming environment so you can program this microcontroller through a standard USB connection. Very cheap. It's about $30, $35. It's been with us for 10 years. It's enabled artists and makers of all sorts to create some really interesting, fun projects and not break the bank. So I think if you're not familiar with the Arduino, I encourage you to take a look at and see if in your community there is an Arduino Day event going on, as well as watch this really interesting documentary. It's called Arduino Documentary. And it goes back, actually the origins of the Arduino go back to Italy 10 years ago, where the it was college university or technical university instructors wanted a cost-effective way to actually put some prototyping open hardware for prototyping in students' hands. So that was the genesis of this. So it was birthed out of the need of educators to create create a resource, essentially. And the resource wasn't a textbook, it was an actual piece of hardware.
Very cool. Thanks for that. I was starting to say something before, but I realized my mic was dead, so that was probably why partly the banjo came jumping in, was because Grant, I thought there was dead air, and I thought I was talking. I just wanted to say one little thing, Darcy, about the radio thing. You were talking about copyright. Your campus radio station might have a legacy license for SOCAN. I know a lot of campus radio stations were kind of granted these very low-cost, copyright-cleared kind of flat-fee licenses. And if you do have a relationship with them, you might be able to come in under that. So,
awesome. Thanks, Brian. I was also concerned about things that aren't just like traditional radio music stuff, because I'm guessing there's going to be like movies and like all kinds of stuff
right.
that may or may not be under that license. But yeah, thanks. I'll check it out.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure exactly how that'll work, but that was a piece of advice I'd gotten from someone else at one point. Was relationships with campus stations can sometimes provide some legal cover around that. Anyway, we are very near the end of the time. Grant, thank you so much. You rule as ever. And my goal was to just give everybody a little taste of the unsinkable Grant Potter. And we did. We had that. That was fantastic. Before we signed off, I wonder if anybody has, I thought we might just do a real light round of people, things to announce or anything. I know that in the next little while, there's going to be a BC Campus Open Textbook Summit. It's going to be really exciting, and I'm hoping to have some fun things to report from TRU on that, because that's really picking up. BCNet, I don't know how many of you will be there, but there will be a panel on open platforms. It would be awesome if people are involved with that. CNIE in mid-May. Call for proposals. I'm just thrilled about some of the people who have registered for that. Does anyone else want to plug anything before we sign off or just have an announcement? Also, too, just want to point out, too, that if anyone has seen on David Wiley's blog, he talks about taking the Lumen Learning open course frameworks, which I always thought was really fantastic, interesting work, and he plans to transition it to an open source kind of instantiation of WordPress that he's calling Candela, and he's got Bill Fitzgerald, who's a very skilled developer, working with him on that. So that's really exciting. And yes, Mary, thank you for posting that link to the Open Textbook Summit. I am really looking forward to attending that. Does anyone else have anything to jump in on before we sign off?
Yeah, just one quick note over here, or of another sort of open education related effort going on in the province is Leva Lee at BC Campus is sort of growing I think she's calling it the BC OER Guides group. And it's sort of a grassroots group of post-secondary librarians interested in OER, and they're slowly getting off the ground of looking at how librarians can support the use of quality OER by faculty and students. So it's a really interesting group, and if you know librarians who would be interested in that work, definitely send them to Leva, and I can post her email address in the comments.
Great. Thanks, Will. Anyone else? Well, I had a blast. This was a great way to end Open Education Week for me, and so many cool people taking part today and joining us. It was really cool. Thank you for everyone, and thank you, Grant Potter, as ever. You just keep bringing such grooviness to this community and to the open ed thing in general. So with that, I'll sign off, and as always, keep on rocking in the open ed world, and doot doot la doot 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 doot. Thank you.